Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The Postal Service managed to cut hiring times thanks to some reforms back in 2019. But for thousands of job postings, it gets no applicants. Those are among the top findings of an audit by the Postal Inspector General. For details, we turn to the Deputy Assistant IG for Finance, Pricing, and Human Capital, Alan McMullen, who joins me in studio. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
So you studied reform that actually started in 2019 for the Postal Service. What were they trying to accomplish, and what's happened in the intervening years?
The Postal Service was aiming to kind of streamline its hiring process and reduce the time to hire. And they took some pretty significant steps back in, like as you mentioned, in 2019. And so our audit was looking at how successful those steps were through the course of our scope period was fiscal year 21 to 2023.
And in that period, how many people did they hire, and what were the hiring time delta between 2019 and, say, the more recent hires?
Yeah, so we found that the steps that they took were pretty successful, and when they are able to identify candidates, they can bring them on very quickly. And so we saw a significant reduction in hiring time over the scope period. They reduced it by almost 35%. And most recently, from time that the job announcement is posted to when they can get the employee officially on the record, is about 30 days.
So that's almost as fast as industry.
If they can find the candidates to apply, they're very efficient in bringing them on board.
And we'll get to that. But mm-hmm. What do they do differently specifically? What could another agency learn from this?
The hiring before was a little bit more decentralized. So they centralized the hiring process. They transitioned to a fully electronic application process. They eliminated interview requirements. And they also adjusted their background investigation processes, which gives them the ability to provide interim clearances to bring people on quicker while they finish the full background investigation while they're on board.
And the fact that they eliminated interviews in many cases means we're talking about production jobs, maintenance jobs, people delivering mail, where if you can physically do it, there's not that much need for what?
These are the positions you think of when you think of the Postal Service, your mail carriers, your clerks at retail post offices, and also those that are working in plants sort of processing the mail.
And also the report refers to pre-career positions. What does that mean in the postal context?
Yes, pre-careers are temporary workers. They don't receive the same benefits as career employees, and they're not always guaranteed a regular schedule. So typically the Postal Service brings staff on as the pre-career position, and it's almost kind of like a probationary period where they can work towards the career status that provides them the longer-term benefits that are associated with the Postal Service.
And is there any evidence that by using the streamlined process, not so many interviews and so forth, the retention and quality of the employees changed or maintained?
I'm not sure that it would have an impact on the retention, which is a long-standing challenge within the Postal Service, particularly amongst the pre-career ranks. As we mentioned, they don't always have a guaranteed schedule, and sometimes they work, you know, more than what was anticipated. So we're actually seeing turnover rates above 50% for the pre-career workforce. So this has sort of been a long-standing challenge for the Postal Service. So anytime we're doing audits in this space, we're always looking for opportunities where they might be able to improve retention.
So they get people in faster, but the retention really didn't improve.
I would say that it didn't have an effect on retention. I think there was a long-standing challenge prior to this, and it still remains. Now, once the staff move from pre-career to career, the retention rate improves. So it's primarily in that pre-career role that they are experiencing challenges.
And that's a different challenge than the speed to hiring in the first place.
Absolutely.
All right. We're speaking with Alan McMullen. He's Deputy Assistant Inspector General for Finance, Pricing, and Human Capital at the U.S. Postal Service. You also found some problems, particularly with nobody applying to a lot of jobs. Give us the details there.
As we mentioned, when Postal Service is able to identify candidates, they can bring them on quickly. But there are many locations where the Postal Service is not able to attract candidates to apply to its job announcements. During our scope period, the Postal Service issued over 700,000 postings, but it did not receive applications for more than half. And this is particularly acute in certain locations, with some districts not receiving applicants in upwards of 80% of its postings.
And where does this tend to happen? Is it more the rural areas, more the urban areas, or what?
It's actually a little bit of a mix there. And we see it in areas where there might be higher costs of living, rising competitive wages from other employers, and also just the overall national unemployment rate.
People that are looking for bargaining unit type of jobs or production types of jobs have other options.
They do have other options, and also the preferences of the workforce may not perfectly align with the Postal Service. The Postal Service is a fabulous employer, and they offer a lot of great benefits, long-term retirement packages, health insurance. But the priorities of the workforce, that doesn't necessarily align with all people looking for jobs, that where they might just be looking for short-term opportunities with just the most amount of money they can get at that time.
Sure. Plus, they're competing in some level, the Postal Service, with UPS, which is unionized and pretty aggressive and really good pay and benefits, and FedEx that tries to keep up with UPS on that front. So that market of sorting things and delivering things is itself competitive.
Absolutely. It's an incredibly competitive marketplace right now to attract employees.
And you had some recommendations for ginning up more applicants, and the Postal Service didn't quite agree with them.
That's true. So we our recommendation was, and while there's challenges everywhere, we thought that the Postal Service should focus on the areas where they have particular challenges with hiring employees, and to take some actions at the local level to try to attract more employees. Now, the Postal Service did disagree with this recommendation, and we also want to put ourselves in their perspective as well, too. They are, over the last 2 years, they've hired over 200,000 people. So that's a lot of people that they're bringing on. So I think their perspective was a very nationwide approach. And what we're sort of offering is the opportunity to tailor some of their efforts at the local level. So while they did disagree initially, we do have a pretty robust resolution process. And so we're pretty confident that we can, you know, work through with the Postal Service to find some solutions that they would be on board with to improve their efforts in this space.
Yeah, because they centralized it, and that was part of the ability to shorten it and make it more efficient. What are some potential steps that could be done locally that would still comply with national regulations the Postal Service has for its own processes and hiring?
Yeah, so there's a lot of options here, and you know, we will look to the Postal Service to come up with some ideas to attempt to attract more employees, to kind of raise their brand in certain areas, and really market some of the benefits that the Postal Service has. There's also some steps that they can take that they can look into at local levels to provide more options and opportunities for staff to attract them to these positions.
And you also recommended providing facility management an opportunity to include facility-specific information when requesting a job posting. What does that mean?
Retention is a long-standing challenge of the Postal Service. So whenever we are doing audit, we're always looking for ways that during the, in particular in this case, during the hiring process, where there are opportunities to improve retention. And so we found that there's opportunities to improve the job description to make it more specific in certain areas. So candidates know what they're getting themselves into as they go into this into the role. And so hopefully that if they know and they're committed to it, then they're more likely to stay. And we actually also found that that there's opportunities because they centralize the hiring process. There's not as much engagement between the district management and the candidate. So who are you going to work for when you go to this job? And so we thought there was opportunities for more meet and greets between district management and the potential candidates that are coming on board. We found that, you know, while Postal Service might hire an individual, almost 18% of employees didn't show up for that first day orientation. So we thought that emphasizing this practice that they already have in place in some areas,
sure,
could help improve this issue.
And finally, they did agree with your recommendation to reiterate the benefits to facility management of conducting these informal sessions, as you just described.
That's correct. They did.
All right, and they can't give out beer or anything during those sessions, but
they can't do that.
Maybe a tour of the backside of a post office.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right. Alan McMullen is Deputy Assistant Inspector General for Finance, Pricing, and Human Capital at the U.S. Postal Service. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We'll post this interview along with a link to his report at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is, what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency, and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.